Welcome to the ADAA podcast on treating insomnia with cognitive behavioral therapy. Today we're talking with Dr. Virginia Runco. She's a psychologist and a certified behavioral sleep medicine specialist at the Ross Center for Anxiety and Related Disorders in Washington, D.C. In her practice, she treats adults, including college students, who have generalized anxiety, panic disorder, social anxiety, depression, and sleeping problems, as well as those dealing with relationship or adjustment issues. She has a special interest in sleep, and she received specialized training in behavioral sleep medicine at Johns Hopkins University, and she has worked on interdisciplinary sleep medicine teams. She regularly conducts CBT for insomnia, and she assesses clients for the full spectrum of sleep disorders. Welcome, Virginia. We're really happy to have you.
Thanks. I'm happy to be here.
Let's start with basic understanding of insomnia. Can you explain what it is and what it is not? And by that, I mean, it's not just a fitful sleep once in a while, or correct me if I'm wrong. Just tell us what insomnia really is.
Sure. So the criteria, the definition of insomnia is there has to be some kind of difficulty falling or staying asleep, and there is a duration and frequency criteria. So, it's not just an occasional night, but it's more like three or more nights a week for at least 3 months. More so, it's not just really a nighttime issue, but it does have to trickle into the daytime in some way. So there are daytime symptoms, whether it be fatigue, sleepiness, concentration issues, or purely just distress that I'm not going to sleep tonight, I'm worried about that, and that's causing me daytime problems as well. Also, what it is not is difficulty sleeping because of external constraints. So let's say you're staying up late at night, so you can't sleep in a sense, but it's because you're staying up late to do work. So it's more of a voluntarily staying up, or then you have to wake up early to take care of the baby. So insomnia is really that you have the opportunity to sleep and you're unable to sleep in those opportunities.
Okay. So how is insomnia related to anxiety and depressive disorders? And is that a risk factor for those disorders, or do those disorders increase the risk for insomnia?
It's complicated. So it's definitely a bidirectional relationship, in that insomnia can increase the likelihood of having depressive and anxiety symptoms, as well as the other direction. So if you have an anxiety disorder, you have depression, that increases your risk for having insomnia. Of course, you have some people that don't have one or the other, but oftentimes they do co-occur.
So does having these disorders at the same time affect the treatment for insomnia?
It can. I kind of talk to patients and try to gauge the severity of each. So if there is both, let's say, anxiety and insomnia, if the anxiety is very, very, very severe, that might be a problem with just doing pure CBT for insomnia. And so I might recommend focused treatment for anxiety in parallel to doing the CBTI. Or we might shift our focus in CBTI to really work on stress management and anxiety protocols first.
So how do you go about planning treatment for someone diagnosed with insomnia? And when is it appropriate? You've touched on that a little bit. Is there anything you can add a little more specifically?
Yes. So first off, talking with the patient, because CBT for insomnia is very much a patient-motivated kind of treatment. It's not just getting a pill. And some patients don't want to do the work. They really just want medication. And that's their prerogative. So we have to have that conversation early so we're not banging our heads up against a wall. So having a conversation with them about it. Otherwise, CBTI is really indicated for pretty much any patient that has insomnia that wants to do it. Based on NIH reports, based on the American Academy of Sleep Medicine, they all find and recommend CBTI. There are certain populations where CBTI is contraindicated in terms of some of the protocol strategies, like untreated sleep apnea or epilepsy or bipolar disorder. You might have to modify the CBTI protocol, but it doesn't mean you can't do it.
Okay. So aside from doing the work and not just taking a pill, what can someone in this treatment expect? Talk a little bit about what is involved and what's expected of them, and if there's a typical or expected length of time before they might see an improvement.
So with what it involves, it's a pretty clear-cut protocol. It's a short-term treatment, usually 4 to 8 sessions or so weekly, ideally. And during that time, there's a lot of sleep education that's given to the patient, learning new behavioral and cognitive strategies, which can include things like stimulus control, which is just using the bed for sleep, getting out of bed when you can't sleep. Sleep restrictions are part of sleep CBTI as well, which is limiting the sleep window. Standard cognitive therapy is done as well, but looking specifically at negative thoughts related to sleep or the lack of sleep on daytime functioning, relaxation training, review of sleep hygiene, things like that. In terms of the expected length of time before they might get better, it varies, but typically what we say is that after, you know, the standard 2 months of treatment or so, most patients are at least 50% better with their symptoms.
Oh, that's wonderful. So,
and again, that's pretty short term when you think about it.
That is. Mm-hmm. That's very good. So what can patients do to make their treatment more effective?
The number one thing is really to comply and really execute and buy into the process. And if they're having difficulty really working with the therapist and approaching and saying, like, these are the struggles I'm having, you know, that therapist should be a coach for them. And so if they're having struggles, be honest with it, but they have to have the motivation. And hopefully they understand the rationale for what they're doing too. And if they're not, then maybe that's more on the therapist's end and they have to work on that to try to convince the patient in a sense. But the patient has to have an open mind, have a little faith in the process and know that it might get worse before it gets better.
That's good to know. So when it comes to friends and family members, what can they do to help?
I mean, obviously, overall support with the process is going to be helpful so the patient doesn't feel as alone. But again, because compliance is really such a big factor in CBT for insomnia, there's little things that patient, family and friends can do that's great. Like if the patient has to now stay up much later, then maybe enlisting the help of some friends on the West Coast to Skype with them or talk to them at night to help them stay up later, or having a family member give them a wake-up call early in the morning if that's part of the CBTI recommendations as well.
Okay. So what questions should people ask their mental health professionals to make sure they're getting appropriate treatment?
Really, what they should be asking about if they're interested in CBT for insomnia, so kind of doing the work, if you will, and not just taking pills, is asking directly for that, especially not just mental health providers, but even primary care physicians. The standard right now is, you know, giving out sleeping medications, and they really don't go beyond that. They might give them a list of sleep hygiene recommendations, and then it ends there. So if the patient says, hey, I heard that there's this thing called CBT for insomnia, can you find me somebody? Then that might prompt the mental health provider or the primary care physician to ask their network of people who does this, and therefore they would look for the specialized people that are these behavioral sleep medicine specialists.
Good. Is there anything else that you'd like to add? Anything new on the horizon?
I would say something that I've been interested in trying to figure out how to work into my clinical practice are these online CBTI programs that are becoming quite developed and very interactive. And that's really getting at the point that there's so few CBTI specialists compared to, you know, the 10% of the population that has insomnia. So how can we treat all these people? And so having the online programs where patients pay a certain fee and then they have access to the program for a few months, they can kind of learn the basic information. And so there's some research coming out showing that these are, you know, pretty effective in trying to get them better. Not sure if they're as or more effective, probably not more effective than an actual in-person therapy session for CBTI. But I think that's really neat and can really be a great tool.
Yeah, so it would be a complement, if not just a substitute at points.
Right, and I kind of see it as like worst case scenario, because you're going to have people that are in rural areas that just aren't going to have access to CBTI. Like, that's just the way it is. And so at the very least, they might be able to do something like this. There's also CBTI books out there, but that takes a level of motivation to kind of go through it. Even these online programs take a certain level of motivation to log on, sit there for an hour in front of your computer once a week. But at least, you know, there's pictures and it's more interactive than just a book. So I see it as, very least, that can be a blanket for some people. And then ideally, if they're in an area where they can see a specialist, that's best.
That would be great. Thank you so much. This is Jean Kaplan-Tycro for ADAA.
Okay.